Hello there. Today is Thursday, May 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, we have breaking news at this hour. An Egypt airplane heading from Paris to Cairo has gone missing. Renewed hope after one of the kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls is rescued. A provocative Calvin Klein ad is getting a lot of backlash. Donald Trump has no problem speaking to one of the world's most reclusive leaders.
I would speak to him. I would have no problem speaking to him.
It's all on today's International Edition. We begin with breaking news at this hour. Egypt Airlines is confirming that flight MS-804, which departed Paris heading to Cairo, has gone missing. It's disappeared from radar. We are waiting for more information from the airline. They're not saying much more than to confirm that the flight is, in fact, missing. It was supposed to land about 2 hours ago. We continue to follow this developing story. We'll bring you more details as they come in. We do know there were 59 passengers and 10 crew members on board Egypt Air flight MS-804 at this point. Nowhere to be found. You can also check in for developments on voanews.com for the latest information. In other news, 41 years after the end of one of the most divisive wars in American history, experts say ties between the U.S. and Vietnam have never been closer. The issue will be front and center during President Obama's visit to Vietnam on Sunday. VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sain joins me in studio to talk about it. Cindy, what do we expect?
All eyes are focused on whether or not President Obama will lift the decades-long arms embargo. And the Vietnamese are asking that he lift the embargo. They're saying, look, we need to stand up to China, which has been increasingly aggressive in the region, on the border and in the South China Sea. And also, there seems to be some internal debate within the Obama administration, with some high-ranking people in the Defense Department saying, yes, we need to bolster our ties with Vietnam. It's time to lift this embargo. But the sticking point is really concerns about human rights, which continue to be a concern.
Now, I know you spoke about this trip with Republican Senator John McCain. What did he have to say about it? Is he in support of lifting the embargo? Is he in support of the president taking this trip?
Senator McCain, of course, was the Republican presidential nominee in 2008. He is a decorated Vietnam War veteran. He was a prisoner of war in Hanoi for 5.5 years and suffered torture and neglect. But he is very much in support of the trip. Mm-hmm. He supported normalizing relations. He says the people of Vietnam are wonderful and that the U.S. and Vietnam, that both, you know, they need each other. He's for, you know, strengthening relations. As to the arms embargo, he said he would like to increase our military support of Vietnam, but he thinks it should be incremental, step by step, and should be linked to improvements in the human rights record.
Any idea what the president will be doing when he gets there?
I know that he will be starting in Hanoi and then also going to Ho Chi Minh City. It's a rather long visit, having talks, meeting, but we don't have the exact schedule yet, so it's going to be a bit of a surprise.
And you're going?
Yes, that's right. Very excited.
So you'll be following along with the president?
Yes.
And covering all of it?
That's right.
Step by step. Now, I know that's not the only stop. We have the big G7 summit in Japan. The president will be heading, and he will also be going to Hiroshima, which is the first time for a sitting U.S. president since, of course, that dreadful day.
Yes, that's right. And in advance of this, or when this was announced, the White House said that the president is not planning to apologize for dropping the atomic bomb, but to express regret for the suffering caused. So it will be a difficult balancing act for the president to strike the right tone, but he has made nuclear non-proliferation such a centerpiece of his presidency. And I think that that is going to be his main focus, is on looking forward and saying, we in the world, we never want something like this to have to happen again.
Right. So very symbolic.
That's right.
As Cindy travels with the president, you can read more about it on our website at voanews.com. Now let's take a look at what's trending online with our social media reporter, Michael Lippin. Hi, Michael. I hear there's a lot of buzz going on about a popular TV actress. Who and what are we hearing about?
Hi, Lori. We're actually talking about Robin Wright. She stars in the U.S. TV drama series House of Cards as the First Lady of the United States, a ruthless and calculating character named Claire Underwood. Now, in what may be a case of life imitating art, Wright revealed on Tuesday that she did something that her TV persona might admire. Wright said that she demanded that series producer Netflix raise her salary to make it equal to her male co-star Kevin Spacey, or she would go public with complaints about pay inequality. According to her, they agreed, and she went public about the issue anyway. It's one of the top trending topics on Facebook today.
So how have Facebook users been reacting?
Well, in a variety of ways. Jonathan Shearman wrote this comment on a CNN article about Robin Wright. He said, Kevin Spacey was making $500,000 per episode. She was making $420,000. His character is more vital to the show. That's why he got paid more. But here is a different perspective from Facebook user Gracie Williams on the same article. She said, I'm glad she got the equal pay. Producer, director, actress. Claire's character is just as vital to the show's success as Spacey's President Frank Underwood. You go, girl.
All right. Well, the U.S. space agency NASA also trending on Facebook today. What's up with that?
Well, NASA is getting attention for launching a giant balloon into the sky as part of a first-of-its-kind science experiment. This balloon is so big and high-tech that NASA is calling it a super-pressure balloon, whose goal is to fly around the Earth at an altitude of 33 kilometers. That's high enough to put it in a layer of the atmosphere called the stratosphere. NASA launched the super-pressure balloon from New Zealand's Wanaka Airport on Tuesday, and the video is impressive. You can check it out by going to the Facebook page of NASA Goddard, that's NASA's Space Research Lab, where they've posted a cool video explaining how the balloon is aiming to break all kinds of records. Lori?
All right, thanks, Michael. You can follow him at Michael_Lippin. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the other stories we are following. Egypt Air flight MS-804 has disappeared from radar between Paris and Cairo. We are continuing to follow this story. A U.S. airstrike has killed two high-value individuals in an attack on an Islamic State building in Iraq. Boko Haram, a growing threat in Africa. A rise in death rates of U.S. white women worries health experts. And portrait of a transgender marriage, a couple navigates new roles. You can find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, in an interview with Reuters on Tuesday, said he is open to talking with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in order to try to halt the country's nuclear program.
I would speak to him. I would have no problem speaking to him.
The comment was quickly condemned by Hillary Clinton advisor Jake Sullivan, who highlighted earlier comments in which Trump said he was unlikely to have a good relationship with British Prime Minister David Cameron. I talked to VOA Southeast Asia Bureau Chief Steve Herman about whether Trump's comments are a departure from longstanding U.S. policy.
Well, it absolutely is a departure from the policy of this administration, and it is, whether privately or publicly, a comment that would be most welcomed in Pyongyang, because the North Korean government for some years has been calling for direct talks with the United States about a peace treaty, because we have to remember that the Korean War in 1953 ended with an armistice. So technically, there is still a state of war on the Korean Peninsula, but these calls for peace talks with the United States, of course, irk Seoul. South Korean government does not want to be pushed aside and for Pyongyang and Washington to have direct negotiations. So this sort of comment that a presidential candidate is making in the United States is going to also cause some anger, one would imagine, in Seoul. And another foreign government which is being drawn in to commenting on U.S. presidential candidates, which is not something that foreign leaders traditionally like to do.
As far as foreign policy, though, would this be another indication that maybe he isn't quite clear on how things are, given that the U.S. has no formal diplomatic relations with the country?
I think that foreign policy analysts would remark exactly that Donald Trump is yet ill-informed about the true situation on the Korean Peninsula. And if he has a solid briefing by one of his advisors, who is quite familiar with the history of engaging with North Korea, North Korea's comments about the United States, its ballistic missile and nuclear weapons development programs, the state of those programs, and the type of rhetoric that has come out of Pyongyang directed both at Seoul and Washington, and with Seoul being a very close ally of the United States, that he may have some different comments besides just wanting to talk to Kim Jong-un.
Now, I know you have really an insider's perspective on the situation in North Korea. In 2013, you spent more than a week with the KPA, the North Korean military.
Yes, I was with the Korean People's Army in North Korea for about 9 or 10 days a few years ago. And obviously, this was a rare opportunity to get some insight not only into the country, but also into how North Korean military officers view the rest of the world. And they do feel under siege, that they have a concern that the U.S. military is going to attack them at any time. Because if you've grown up in North Korea, that's what you've heard practically since birth, that the United States is the enemy and is looking to destroy North Korea. Other people may regard them as quite paranoid, but that is definitely a pervasive mentality in the country. We'll also have to see how the country reacts should a candidate or President Donald Trump make bellicose comments towards North Korea, much in the same vein as the typical comments from Pyongyang towards Washington.
While North Korea is under multiple rounds of UN sanctions targeting its nuclear weapons program and repeated banned missile tests. Meanwhile, the U.S. presidential candidates are still seeking votes and convention delegates on the road to the White House. As Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders remain in a heated battle, the Democrats are stepping up the pressure to get Sanders to stop International Edition's Jim Stevenson talked about it with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
They wouldn't be going after him as much if Clinton was finding a way to sort of put him away, but she's not. She barely won the Kentucky primary. She lost Oregon. The narrative, though, has taken a little bit of a darker turn now. The longer this has gone on, the tensions between the campaigns have grown. And this is exactly the wrong time for this to happen. Democrats are now worried that as the party seeks to unify, to heal the wounds, to bring Sanders into the Clinton camp to face Donald Trump, presumably, that, you know, the tensions are undermining what they're trying to do. And this was on display most recently at an event last Saturday in Las Vegas. A Nevada state Democratic convention where they choose delegates to go to the convention in Philadelphia in July kind of broke into a mess, with Sanders supporters upset with the Democratic Party leadership, started throwing chairs. There were even threats made against the state party chairwoman. This is the kind of thing Democrats want to stop before it kind of devolves out of control. And it shows you the challenge ahead for both Clinton and Sanders. It's going to take some doing to patch this party up, assuming Clinton remains on track to be the nominee.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump is working the room, if you will. He's been meeting with top Republican leaders and trying to maybe present a more presidential air to his campaign, meeting with Henry Kissinger today.
Yeah, and definitely on foreign policy, I think a lot of Republicans would be endorsing this move. Not necessarily that they think everything Kissinger has to say is something that should be followed, but in the wake of some of the Trump comments, I think Republicans are looking for signs that Trump is going to be listening to the adults in the room and kind of reining in some of his more cavalier and unprompted comments and responses. This is all part of Trump's effort to bring the Republican Party together. And I've also noticed, even in the most recent interview with Megyn Kelly on Fox, He seemed to project a softer tone, not quite as cantankerous, even though in the same interview he said he knows what got him through the primaries, he knows what got him to win, which is his, you know, boisterous nature and saying it like it is, and he has no plans to backtrack. So the challenge for some of the Republicans looking at Trump going forward is which Donald Trump will appear on any given day.
All right, now to a story that began in April of 2014. One of the schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram militants in an infamous mass kidnapping in northeast Nigeria has been rescued, the first to be found since the militant group stormed a school in the town of Chibok and abducted nearly 300 girls. Many escaped immediately, but over 200 remain missing. International Edition's Susan Yackey talked about it with reporter Chris Stein and asks how they managed to find the girl.
Nigeria's military has announced it has rescued one of the over 200 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram militants from Chibok over 2 years ago. It's the first girl to be rescued since the mass kidnapping. Reporter Chris Stein joins us on the line from Lagos. He's following the story. Welcome, Chris.
Hello.
How did they find her?
That remains a little bit unclear. The military says it was she was rescued by their troops in an area called Bale, which is near the town of Bamboa, which is not far from Chibok. But I also spoke with a vigilante group leader who said that she was found while they were laying an ambush for Boko Haram. So the details of this are not really completely known at this point.
Well, is she in good shape?
I understand she's healthy, but I've heard that she was with a baby that she'd given birth to while she was in captivity, as well as a husband who was a fellow captive who she had met while she was in wherever she was.
Well, what is the reaction to her being found?
People are, as one Chibok campaigner told me, people are elated by this. She's the only girl that's been rescued nearly over 2 years since the mass kidnapping that sparked global outrage and, you know, calls to bring back the girls. None of the girls have been found, and they've barely even been seen outside of propaganda videos. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of other people who are also victims of mass abductions rescued by Nigeria's military and the militaries of neighboring countries. But up until today, none of them were the Chibok girls, and there have been plenty of false alarms and false hopes. So I think there's a lot of happiness over this, although it certainly isn't over for the majority of the girls.
Is this announcement fueling hope that more girls may be found?
There's certainly always been that optimism, and the campaigners of the Bring Back Our Girls movement have never really let up in their pressure. They stage marches, they mark anniversaries. Every day if you log on to Twitter, you log on to any other social media platform, you'll see someone who's part of the movement tweeting about the girls, talking about them, and this is a campaign that's never really given up, and I don't expect them to stop until all the girls are found.
You know, in the past, there's been concern about these young girls when they're kidnapped. They come back. Sometimes they're ostracized by others. Is there concern for this girl's future?
I can't really say. She's certainly been through an ordeal, and obviously she's also going to be facing a lot of attention from the public because of her status as, one of the girls who has been rescued. In fact, the only girl who has been rescued. So I imagine that she has a lot in front of her. I've heard other tales of former kidnapped, abducted people facing stigma from their communities because of their association with Boko Haram, which has caused so much hardship and bloodshed in Nigeria's north, and particularly its northeast. But, at this point, I think she's probably just trying to get reintegrated back into the real world.
Well, we've since learned that the girl has been reunited with her mother and is providing some information about the other girls. You can read much more on the story at voanews.com. Now, we have some breaking news to tell you about very quickly here. Egypt Air is confirming that an Airbus A320 flight MS-804, which departed Paris heading to Cairo, has gone missing. It disappeared from radar over Egypt. We are waiting for more information from the airline. They're not saying much more than to confirm that the flight is in fact missing. It was supposed to land a few hours ago. We'll continue to follow this story and bring you more details as they come in. And of course, check on voanews.com for all the very latest information. This is International Edition.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. also join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Well, this is VOA's International Edition. A racy new Calvin Klein ad is causing outrage among advocates who say it is crossing the line. I talked about it with Haley Halverson, communications director for the National Center for Sexual Exploitation, who explains what upskirting is and why it sends a bad message.
So upskirting is a growing trend of sexual harassment, where pictures are taken up a woman's skirt or dress without her knowledge or without her consent. This activity is a crime in many states like New Jersey, California, and Arizona. And so it's actually very socially irresponsible for Calvin Klein to be glamorizing this form of sexual harassment. And so we're definitely calling on them to remove the ad and also to issue an apology to victims of sexual harassment or assault.
And so what are you guys doing to try to bring greater awareness about this? I know you've really been pushing hard to get them to stop this.
Yes, we've launched a campaign, which you can find at endsexualexploitation.org/Calvin. And in that, we are calling on Calvin to remove the ad. We're also encouraging the public to pledge boycotting Calvin Klein with the hashtag #ICutCalvin. To cut up any products of Calvin Klein's that they own, send them back to their headquarters. And also at that website, endsexualexploitation.org/Calvin, there's a petition that you can sign. It already has thousands of signatures, and so we're encouraging people to sign that petition so that Calvin Klein gets the message that people don't want them promoting these themes.
It really does mimic the often exploited upskirt shots that are found on pornography sites.
It does. These kinds of photos that are taken of women in real life, real victims, are often uploaded onto the internet. And what's really disturbing about this ad by Calvin Klein is it is a picture from the perspective of the person taking the photo. So it's turning any viewer into a vicarious participant. And it's sending a message that because women's bodies are in public, that means that they're public property, which we adamantly disagree with.
Calvin Klein has a long history of doing pretty provocative ads, and it seems to work for them. Why would you think that they would change it now when it seems to be profiting them?
I think that the culture at this point is a lot more educated about the problems of sexual assault and violence, not only the rising sexual assault on college campuses and in the military, but also in their communities. And so the culture is no longer at a point where any messages that are promoting or glamorizing rape culture are acceptable anymore. And so I think that Calvin Klein has bit off more they can chew with this ad and will hopefully be quick to take it down.
I read somewhere that no matter how many negative comments they get, that it will only benefit them in profit.
I don't think that a lot of people looking at that ad say that they want to be that girl. Advertising is about making someone feel empowered by your product, and instead they're showing their product in an exploitive way where a victim of sexual harassment. And so I think that a lot of people will not go to Calvin Klein anymore. I know that we've received a lot of feedback from people pledging to cut Calvin and to no longer patron their stores over this ad.
All right. Thanks so much, Haley Halverson with the National Center for Sexual Exploitation. This is International Edition. It's been nearly 20 years since country music superstar Garth Brooks played for an audience in New York City. But as International Edition's David Byrd reports, the multiple Grammy Award winner is set to play at Yankee Stadium in July.
Blaming all of my roots, I showed up in bed. And ruined your blind time fear.
The last time Garth Brooks played New York City, 750,000 people showed up for his 1997 Central Park show. Brooks, who has also won multiple Entertainer of the Year awards from the Country Music Association, returns to the Big Apple with a concert at Yankee Stadium July 9th. At a news conference for the show, Garth said that he jumped at the chance to play in New York again, especially at Yankee Stadium.
It wasn't my thought. It wasn't my brainchild. The Yankees actually came to us and said, "Man, would you ever think about playing Yankee Stadium?" It's like, I guess not, but I guess I dream of it, you know. And so I said, are you really serious? Is this possible? They said, yeah. I said, well, what a way to return to New York after Central Park. So this makes sense. If you're going to do anything big, you do it in this city. If you're going to do something big in this city, Central Park, Yankee Stadium, I think that's the way to do it.
Brooks, who released his latest album of original songs in 2014 after a 13-year hiatus, said he wanted to perform for his devoted fans. The 54-year-old singer and guitarist said he gets emotional when he thinks about what music has meant to him.
Well, they talk about your musical heroes or what music means to you. Man, you don't talk about what music means to me, it's going to get really sappy really quick, because that's my breath in and my breath out.
Garth Brooks's tour has recently sold its 4 millionth ticket, but he says he still enjoys watching and learning from other performers.
Well, I mean, you got guys like Jason Aldean, who's a true entertainer, which I like. And I know it's not country we're talking about. We just saw Justin Timberlake, another true entertainer. I was lucky enough to get to see Beyonce's Vegas show that she built solely for Vegas. I got to see it in person. Entertainer. I mean, take out your notebook and take notes. No matter how long you've been on the stage, take notes on that one. And just guys like that. I love them.
Tickets for the Yankee Stadium show go on sale May 20th. Brooks and his wife, Trisha Yearwood, will perform, but there's no definite word on whether New York's own Billy Joel, who joined Brooks in his 1997 show, will also be there. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
That's going to do it for this edition of International Edition. Stay with VOAnews.com for the latest on Egypt Air flight that has disappeared from radar en route from Paris to Cairo. It's a developing story we are continuing to follow. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Lori London. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Japan are leaders in the global digital economy, not just as producers and consumers, but as advocates for policies that enable its existence and development. Our partnership is strong, said U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and U.S. Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy, Daniel Sepulveda, because we both believe that promoting continued global connectivity holds the potential to help lift people out of poverty, formalize the informal economy around the world, increase the efficiency of supply chains, increase the productivity of workers, raise wages, and improve people's lives. At the recent G7 Information and Communications Technology Ministers meeting in Japan, a new charter for the digitally connected world was agreed to. The Charter reaffirms fundamental principles, including promoting and protecting human rights, promoting and protecting the free flow of information, supporting the multi-stakeholder approach to internet governance, and strengthening digital connectivity and supporting inclusiveness for all. The Global Connect Initiative, launched by the U.S. last fall, is a large-scale effort to increase internet access around the world. The U.S. intends to partner with interested countries, including Japan, to develop strategies to spur connectivity and entrepreneurship, cross-border information flows, and open and competitive marketplaces. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, of which Japan is a part, will play a supporting role in the shared goals of strengthening the global internet. The internet represents the digital shipping lane for 21st century goods and services, and as such, the pending agreements with nations in the Pacific community will establish rules for the preservation of those virtual shipping lanes as means of conveying services and ideas, allowing startups and everyday people to challenge incumbent power in marketplaces and ideas. The United States and Japan share a common vision for the future of the global digital economy by expanding connectivity, keeping digital trade routes open, and creating policy environments that sustain growth and foster innovation. These are valuable long-term efforts, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Sepulveda, and we have the strong bonds as friends and allies that will help us succeed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's four.